BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 212. I want to give a little bit of a teaser for an upcoming podcast. This afternoon, if everything goes right, I'll be interviewing William Anderson. Now, this is William L. Anderson. If you start to look up his name in Google or whatever, you want to get the right William Anderson. William Anderson is an extremely common name. In that sense, it's very much like Ben Stone. Trying to grow up with a name like that, it may not seem all that common. Ben Stone may not seem common, but if you try to find me by just Googling Ben Stone, you're going to find about 100 million other people named that before you find me. So William Anderson is a lot like that. When I first saw his writings over at LouRockwell.com, I thought, William Anderson, huh, that's funny. Back when I was a kid, there was a famous country western music star named Whispering Bill Anderson. And of course, since I love history so much, immediately I thought of Bloody Bill Anderson from the Quantrill's Raiders and the Lincoln's horrible war. But I think you're going to find that Bill Anderson is, William Anderson, that I'm going to interview later today, I think you're going to find he's a very interesting person. He's an author and associate professor of economics at Frostburg State University. He is an adjunct scholar at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and he is an adjunct scholar for the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's formerly a professor of economics at North Greenville College. And as I said a second ago, he's a frequent contributor to LouRockwell.com. And he specializes in something I'm going to be talking about today, justice and prosecutorial abuse in America. He's really a pretty fascinating person. I'm really looking forward to interviewing him here in just a couple hours. And I'm going to try to have that interview up probably Thursday or Friday. I'm not sure which day it will air. It's all according to other circumstances. But if everything goes well, I'll interview Bill Anderson today, and that interview will either be posted Thursday or Friday, as I said, if all goes well. I always like to leave myself outs and not make absolute statements about the future. So, and that brings me to today's situation. Today is going to be part one of a two-part series based on some questions and some email questions and some questions on the BadQuaker.com website that have come up recently. Before I get into that, though, I want to talk about this contest again. If you didn't hear me announce it yesterday, we're having a contest in conjunction with Michael W. Dean, who's a personal friend of mine. He recently did a DVD called Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1, Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz. And he gave me a free copy of the DVD, and I sat down and watched it, and I thought, oh man, I got to get my whole family has to watch this. This is really, really a good DVD. It's almost 100 minutes long, so it's an in-depth and it's a thorough coverage of the basics of handgun and rifle. And it's really good in a lot of ways. It's good in the sense that it's for a beginner. It's really, really got some good foundational stuff in it. But even for the experienced gun handler, it has stuff you might not have thought about, or it has things that maybe you haven't refreshed lately in your mind. And it also deals with the non-aggression principle. Now, you don't find a lot of gun handling training coming at it from a principled, non-aggressive point of view. So it's very unique in that sense. And I'll put a link in today's podcast notes where you can buy that DVD. But we're also having this contest. Now, this contest is only good between today, the 9th of October, and the 14th of October in 2012. So if you're hearing this in this podcast in an archive, or if you're hearing it after Sunday, October 14th, 2012, this contest is over. So, you know, keep that in mind. Now, the way the contest is going to work, you need to go to Facebook, and you need to find badquaker.com, spelled out Bad Quaker, D-O-T-C-O-M, and you need to post on the badquaker.com Facebook page these words: I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. That's, I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. You need to post that on the badquaker.com Facebook page. If you don't have an account with Facebook, that's okay. You can email badquaker@badquaker.com, and in the subject line, put DVD. And in the body of the email, put, I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. You put that in the body of the email. Now, let me promise you, we won't sell, we won't trade, or we don't do anything stupid or evil with your email address. We never will do that. That's unethical, and we won't do it. This coming Sunday, the 14th, what I'm going to do is I'm going to number all of the entries, and then I'm going to call Michael W. Dean, and he's going to pick a number. Now, let's say there's, who knows how many will enter, but let's say 100 people enter. So I'll number 1 to 100 all of the entries. And Michael will have no idea the order that I've numbered them in. And I'm going to call Michael W. Dean, and Michael's going to give me a number. Let's say there's 100, so he'll give me a number between 1 and 100. And whatever number, whatever name matches that number, that'll be the winner. And we'll try to contact them within 24 hours. Now, there are some rules that we have to stick with. This is for U.S. addresses only. We can't mail these outside of the U.S. right now. So this is for U.S. addresses only. You must be 21 years or older. There's no purchase necessary. And it's not valid where prohibited by evil overlords. And, of course, the contest ends October 14th, 2012. That's this coming Sunday. And I'm going to make this announcement again at near the end of the podcast, because since we're on the radio in some locations, you know, sometimes people come in at later points in the podcast or whatever. So if you didn't get that copy down, I will be repeating it near the end of the podcast. Okay, now, the two topics that have come up in emails and on the Bad Quaker website recently, I'm going to kind of paraphrase the two topics, because they came at me in several forms, but really they boil down to these two questions. And really, if you think about it, it's only one question, but I'll form it in these two questions. How are children's rights protected in a free society, and how are law and justice established in a free society? So that's the two questions that we're looking at. Now, the reason I'm going to have this in two parts is because, you know, there's just real, that's, it's, like I said, it's really only one question, but I'm taking it apart into two questions, and I'm doing that specifically so that I can cover it a little bit more thoroughly than I might under other circumstances, having some trouble talking today. And for the purpose of this topic, I want to let you know that there's a couple of books that I have used to come to the conclusions that I'm going to portray in covering this topic. One is maybe what I might think to be the most important book that anyone concerned with liberty should own, and that is For a New Liberty: The Libertarian Manifesto by Murray Rothbard. Now, it's great to have this in electronic form. It's available at the Mises Institute as a download for free in electronic form. It's available for free as an audio book over there. You can get it chapter by chapter. It's not easy to download each chapter like that, but it's there and it's free and it's available. And you can get that at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. But this is a book, really, I really believe that every serious libertarian needs to own a hard copy of this book and have it available in their house. And if possible, you need to own two copies so that if you ever get in a real conversation with a person who's serious, not just an internet yes or no type, you know, yelling contest or whatever, but if you're ever in a conversation with a person who's really serious about the topic of liberty, you can hand them this book as a gift and say, everything you need to know is in this book. It's in one place. It's exhaustive, and it's thorough. And Murray really did a good job on this book, For a New Liberty, The Libertarian Manifesto. There'll be a link in today's show notes where you can get it at Amazon. The second book I want to mention that's critical to understanding this is by Robert P. Murphy. I had Bob Murphy on the podcast here a few weeks back. His book is called Chaos Theory. Now, this is not a new book. It's from, probably 2001, 2002, 2003, somewhere in there. It's an older book, which means it's cheaper. And I'll put a link in the show notes for that book also. Chaos Theory by Robert P. Murphy. Whenever you're Googling Bob Murphy's name on the internet, especially if you're thinking about the topic of law, you want to be sure and Google Robert P. Murphy, and not just Robert Murphy and not just Bob Murphy, because there are attorneys named Robert Murphy. So if you Google Robert P. Murphy, you'll always come up with the right Bob Murphy. So we've got For New Liberty, Chaos Theory, and then there's an article on the internet that is a really good article, and it's called The Obviousness of Anarchy by John Hassness, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name, Hassness. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name. He is a very respected individual. He's an associate professor of law at Georgetown University School of Law. He had a BA from Lafayette College, a JD, a PhD from Duke, and an LLM from Temple. So this is a scholarly examination of the topic, and it's in a single article, and I'll provide a link to it. You can get over there and read it. It's not a short article, but it's much shorter than reading an entire book, but it's really, really good. If you want to point somebody to something on the internet that they can just sit down and read it, and it won't take that long, this is probably the best single article I've ever found on the topic. And again, the name of it is The Obviousness of Anarchy, and I'll provide a link in today's show notes. So what we have here is For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard is a fairly good-sized book, and it's thorough, and you really need to take some time and digest it slowly. Chaos Theory is a great, much smaller book, but it's a great book by Bob Murphy, and it's really handy to have. For a New Liberty is a must. You have to have it. The Chaos Theory is a good book to have, and the Obviousness of Anarchy article that's on the internet is really handy once you read it for yourself and understand it. It's really handy in a conversation to just, you know, you type it out in a forum or on chat or whatever and just say, well, look, just go and read this. And it kind of covers everything much better than I can cover it. But anyway, so that's the resources that you can look to that support what I'm going to be telling you on this topic. And before, I should say this too, before I address the solution to the problem, it's important to understand the depth of the failure of the state. The very things that we're told can't exist without the state are the very things that the state fouls up the most. The very things that we're told hold society together are the things that the state threatens society through its failures. So it's really important. It's like, it's like if you were driving down the road in a super expensive luxury automobile. And you've got on your dash, you've got all these electronic doodads that control and monitor everything to do with the car. And let's say you're driving along in your luxury car and a little light flashes on your dash and you look down and it's like, oh, look, the air pressure that's supposed to be 50 pounds is showing it's dropped to 48 in my rear right tire. Well, interesting. So you reach down, you reset that little button, you know. And the light goes out, and you think, well, the next time I go to a fully service filling station, I'll be sure and pull in and have the attendant fill that tire. And you might think about it. You might notice. You might look down every now and then at the gauge. But you're not really going to think about it much. Now, that's entirely different from a scenario where you're driving along in your car and you look in your rearview mirror and you see smoke coming out of the back of your car and you're like, hey, what's going on? You look around and there's flames coming up from the sides of your car and you're like, oh, crap. And you pull your car over and you jump out as quick as possible and you abandon it while it burns. Now, this is the situation with the state. It's important to understand when we're looking at the failures of the state, we're not just talking about, you know, a gauge being off by a couple pounds. Maybe we'll take care of that in a little while. We're not talking about that. We're talking about this state is in flames. And I'm not talking about the United States or a specific government. I'm talking about this mythology of the state. This thing is in flames, and it's going to burn anybody who stays inside of it. And the only way to take care of this situation is to, as quickly as possible, abandon it. You don't see those flames coming up around the sides of your car, and you don't go, well, perhaps the next fire station I see, I'll pull in and let the lads put out this fire. You don't think like that. You say, crap! And you slam on your brakes and you get your family out of this thing as quickly as possible. And that's the situation we're facing with the state. And again, not the government, the state. The state at some point is going to collapse. And the quicker we can prepare for that and the quicker we can get our minds around what it's going to take to be in a position so when the state collapses, you don't have to rely on it. You can just go on with your life like nothing's happened. The better that you can be in a position like that and the better you can train the next generation to come into that position. Because as I've said before, I don't think, you know, governments rise and fall all the time. That can happen at any particular time. But I don't think the actual collapse of the state is coming anywhere within the next 100 or 150 years or so. It may even be further out than that. But at some point, this thing's going to flame out and collapse. And we have to be in a position of understanding these things before it happens so that we can prepare the generations for it and so that they understand the seriousness of the situation. It's not just a matter of tweaking some dials and adjusting some pressure here and there. It's a matter of flaming out, and that's the situation with the state. And I don't think it's quite. I mentioned Alex Jones on a recent podcast, and I kind of did so in a negative light, and maybe that was a little unfair of me, but I don't see the kind of constant panic that Alex Jones tends to push. I don't see that as being all that productive for us once we're in here and once we see what the state is really like. That kind of thing is productive as far as waking people up and getting them to look and see that, hey, this is on fire. But once you start to understand the depth of the evil of the state, then you start to see that this thing is much bigger, much older, and it almost has its own personality. Well, I would argue it does have its own personality. This beast is almost a living entity. It is quite literally a god. It is a man-created god. And the more we begin to understand it and more we begin to understand its nature, then the more we begin to understand what can be done about it. So in this first part of the discussion on these topics, that's what I'm going to focus on. I'm going to focus on first explaining how serious the problem is, and then I'm going to go to how children's rights are protected in a free society and how law and justice are established in a free society. But before I can do that, this first podcast has to focus on how serious the problem is currently, and then I'll get to the rest. So stick with me. I'll be right back. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Now, I'm going to come at this at a slightly different angle, maybe, than you might have heard before. If you've heard an anarcho-capitalist talking about, you know, what's wrong with the current system, or, you know, what can be done to replace the current system, or, you know, how would this function without the state, or how would that function without the state? How would we have roads without the state? How would we have defense, you know, from foreign invaders without the state? Or I'm going to address this slightly different. Even in the concept of the failures of the state to provide these things, I hope I'm going to bring a slightly different view to this. I want to talk about two concepts within economics, two realities of economics. One is called regulatory capture, and the other is self-selection bias. Now, don't worry, when I say they're concepts of economics, that doesn't mean we're going to do math. It has nothing to do with math. Most economists who whip out, most economists who whip out a bunch of numbers and their calculator, and they start talking about, you know, they start using fancy words in regards to monetary this or that. Most of that is smoke and mirrors to give you the impression they know something that they really don't. And all they're really trying to do is sell you on an idea that ends up, you know, supporting their position. But that's not what I'm going to do. That's not the kind of economics that I'm talking about. When I talk about regulatory capture and self-selection bias, these are aspects of economics in the sense, like kind of like what Ludwig von Mises would talk about in praxology. It's not, it's not numbers. It's more about human nature and the way humans interact with each other, and the reasons that they make the decisions, and the reason they act the way that they do. So as you understand things like regulatory capture and self-selection bias, you begin to look at aspects of human nature, and you begin to understand why people do what they do, and you understand why certain agencies are guaranteed to fail, and why certain acts of government, or in some cases certain acts of corporations, are guaranteed to produce negative results, no matter the intentions of the people involved. So let me just give you a quick definition of regulatory capture. Regulatory capture occurs when a state regulatory agency created to act in the public interest instead advances the commercial or special interests that dominate the industry or sector that it's charged with regulating. Regulatory capture is a form of government failure, as it can act as an encouragement for the large firms to produce negative externalities. The agencies are called captured agencies when this takes place. Now, I'll give you a couple examples of regulatory capture. The classic example is from the mid-1800s. We had a situation in the United States where, actually this is early to mid-1800s, we had a situation where railroads were a new industry, and there were a lot of venture capitalists, a lot of entrepreneurs that were jumping into it full force, and they were very excited about it. And so you'd have railroads with rails of different sizes, and you'd have railroads with the tracks themselves at different widths apart from each other. So this is what we talk about with gauges. We talk about the size of the rail itself and how far apart they are. And so there needed to be standards. And so so this was used as an excuse by certain more successful railroad entrepreneurs. And so they used the aggression of government to create, to force government to create agencies that would supposedly standardize the things that were in the railroad industry. Now, the railroad industry was already standardizing these things at a pretty quick rate. They were coming up with things like the time zones. The time zones were established by voluntary interactions between the railroads. It was not a thing that was mandated by government. All the time zones that we know of today happened because the railroad companies cooperated with each other and came up with these standards. They're not perfect, but they're better than what existed prior to that. So the purpose of these agencies that were developed to regulate the railroad industry was not to standardize the industry so much, although that was the excuse that was used. The real reason for these regulatory commissions and these organizations that the government created, the real reason was because the more successful railroad companies didn't want the competition from the small upstarts. So they lobbied and got these government agencies that would come in and make all kinds of regulations and all kinds of limitations, and they would just crush the smaller competition on behalf of the bigger companies. So that when you have a situation like that, and it became obvious with the railroads in the 1800s, and that's where economists first started talking about this regulatory capture existing, because it was so obvious that it had taken place in the railroad industry. But it's not just in that industry. It takes place everywhere. The actual industry leaders will come into government, demand, they will use a false situation of some kind, some threat to the public, you know, oh, the world's going to come to an end if we don't regulate the size of this or the shape of that or whatever. If we don't mandate that stairs have, you know, exactly these dimensions, then little old ladies all across the world are going to die by the scores if we don't regulate the size of stairs. And then, of course, the people doing that are the stairway company that wants to get rid of the competition. And I'm just using that as an example. It can be anything. This is the classic example is Monsanto, what they did, the real movers and shakers in the government that regulate the industry that Monsanto is in are former or current Monsanto employees. And the heads of Monsanto are former or current officials in the very government agencies that are supposed to regulate Monsanto. And this is the same in lots of different industries like that. But what most people, or at least most economists, don't think about when they think about regulatory capture is these same pressures, these same economic features happen in the child protection agencies within the government and within law enforcement and in the courts. The regulatory capture is so fundamental that it takes place any time that you have a group of people that are in the government that use the aggression of government to control a particular sector of society. So that can be schools, it can be law enforcement, it can be courts, it can be child protection. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. The other thing I'm going to talk about is self-selection bias. I'll read the definition. Self-selection bias arises in any situation in which individuals select themselves into a group, causing a biased sample with non-probability sampling. It is commonly used to describe situations where the characteristics of the people which cause them to select themselves in the group create abnormal or undesirable conditions in that group. Okay, so an example of this that I always like to give is phone surveys. If you think about who commonly takes phone surveys and who avoids phone surveys, well, unfortunately, the most common people who will take phone surveys are old, lonely people who are maybe not quite in touch with everything that's going on around them, and teenagers who are willing to lie for the fun of taking the survey. And typically, and I know quite a bit about this because I was in the industry for a while, typically a phone survey is targeting a specific target audience. Let's say they want to know the opinion of stay-at-home housewives between the ages of 30 and 45. Okay, so they'll have a series of qualifying questions. They'll make their call, and then they'll have a series of qualifying questions. So it'll be like, are you male or female? Okay, female. Are you between the ages of 20 to 30, 30 to 40, 40 to 50? And they'll narrow these down, and they'll use these qualifying questions to get the right people that they want for their survey. Well, an old person who's lonely, unfortunately, will oftentimes lie because it's not hard to tell when they're going through these questions, especially if the questioner is kind of desperate for numbers. It's not hard to tell how you're supposed to answer the questions when they're going through the qualifying questions. So an old person who's lonely or a teenager who wants to have fun will lie, and they will say whatever they need to say to pass the qualifying questions to get into the heart of the survey. And so when you get into the heart of the survey, then after they've got through the qualifying questions and you get into the heart of the survey, and then what are they saying? You know, it could be anything. What hamburgers do you like, or where do you shop, or, you know, what kind of investments do you use? It doesn't matter what the questions are. You think you're sampling a certain group of people, but you may not be sampling those people because in self-selection bias, there's a tendency for people who select themselves into that group that throw off any results that you might think that you're getting from that group. Now, this happens in law enforcement. It doesn't only happen in phone surveys. It happens in law enforcement. I've talked before about how the Barneys will outnumber the Andes in law enforcement agencies because the whole system is set up to punish the Andes and reward the Barneys. And that's a reference to the Andy Griffith show back from the 60s where Barney was this incompetent cop and Andy was this brilliant cop who was peaceful and kind, and Barney was a little unstable and maybe violent. Anyway, but self-selection bias in something like law enforcement will force the Andes out or force the Andes into lesser position and reward the Barneys. It's built into the system, and I did a whole series on that already. But you also get this in child protective agencies, where angry, psychotic busybodies and lazy slugs tend to dominate child protective services. And there are aspects built into child protective services that reward these angry, psychotic busybodies and the lazy slugs, and it drives out the good people who get involved and really want to do something good in child protective services. Those good people, there are a few in there still, very few, but more and more they get pushed into lesser positions and they get punished for good behavior, whereas these angry, psychotic busybodies get rewarded for doing bad things. And that's the way the agencies are set up. It's a system that guarantees that that's going to take place. So that's how self-selection bias distorts the agencies that are actually created to provide law enforcement and courts and things like child protective services. Self-selection bias and regulatory capture are aspects of government pollution into the market that they guarantee that once these agencies are created, whether we're talking about law enforcement or child protection or anything else, schools, anything else, once they're created, they are destined on a path to do the exact opposite of what it is that good people initially thought that they could do with these agencies. Now, whenever you're considering this topic, always remember these critical factors. I've got 3 points I want to make on this. One, the current system is a complete failure, so much so that no system at all, and any chaos that may bring, is preferable to this failed system based entirely on aggression. Two, by the very nature of a free society and a free market, no one solution would ever be universally acceptable. We can only suggest possibilities. If I or anybody else was to sit down and say, this is how we would build roads under a stateless society, well then I've begun the process of central planning and I'm moving us back towards a state society. So the very fact that the market is full of lots and lots of individuals thinking in different ways and lots of people wanting different things, because of that, no one solution will ever be universally accepted. And number three, the state is an anomaly in the human experience. Humans have survived ice ages that have lasted longer than the state has existed. So the state is simply a temporary illness on society. we were healthy before the state, and when the state dies, we'll be healthy again. But right now, it's like society has a head cold, except it's a deadly head cold that if we don't deal with it, it can actually wipe out the human race. So these three things, I'm going to cover these three things. Today, I'm only going to get into what's wrong with the system, but when I finish this series tomorrow, I'll go into detail on what can be done and maybe what it will look like when we actually have a free society. So now let's review the first one of those. The current system is a complete failure, so much so that no system at all is preferable to this failed system based entirely on aggression. Now consider this. Child Protective Services in the U.S. is the single greatest threat to children living in the U.S., and government-mandated schools in the U.S. are a constant and ongoing contradiction to the myth that children in the U.S. have any rights whatsoever. Now, I'm going to try to back that up a little bit. And it might be a little bit different in other countries, but it's just a matter of time. Until everyone who's under the state will find these things to be true about the state, that any kind of child protective services are the single greatest physical threat to children, and government-mandated schools are a constant and ongoing contradiction to the myth that children have any rights at all. And think about it. Public schools force, under threat of violence, they force children to go into a prison-like atmosphere. They force children to... They take away the right of a child to express themselves verbally, the right of free speech. Children are stuffed into a classroom and not allowed to talk, not allowed to express themselves, not allowed to communicate with their friends. They have to just sit right there and tolerate the indoctrination. They can't even get up and go to the bathroom on their own. You think about what that does to a child's mind, to drive them into a prison-like atmosphere and take away all their rights, force them to sit in, they've already been captured, they've already been abducted by this system, and then they're going to be forced to sit there and listen and answer questions exactly the way that they're asked, exactly the way that they want them to be answered. They can't even get up and go to the bathroom or get something to eat if they want it. They can't communicate with their friends or their family if they want to. They are completely prisoners during the entire government school experience. They have almost no rights. They can be searched. Their effects can be searched. When you send your children into a public school, you have essentially abandoned all their rights for them. Now, in addition to this, what I was talking about, Child Protective Services there, when I come back from this break, I'm going to go into really how deeply evil Child Protective Services are. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Now I wanted to talk about Child Protective Services, and I want to give a couple of examples. There's a guy named Will Grigg, and I've talked to him about having him on the show. I hope he'll come on the show. He's got a really hectic schedule, and I understand if he can't come on the show, but I sure do hope that he comes on the show. Anyway, he has spent years investigating and exposing abuse by different government agencies, including Child Protective Services. He's written on this extensively. And he's done for the field that he's in, he is basically the leader in exposing the government in its failed and abusive agencies like police and courts and things like this. So he's been writing about this for years and writing about Child Protective Services. And then one day, he gets a knock on his door. And what do you know? It's Child Protective Services. And the claim is that someone anonymously has turned them in for something, but they don't have to tell you what you're turned in for. So in other words, an angry neighbor, a disgruntled family member, a passing drunk. Anybody who wants to can just anonymously call Child Protective Services and say they think your children are in danger. And Child Protective Services will swoop in and find some way of connecting this anonymous accusation with some kind of danger that your children are in. And going back to self-selection bias, people who enjoy doing this kind of thing, those psychotic busybodies that I was talking about earlier, they tend to really enjoy this kind of job. So they tend to get themselves hired into jobs like this. As a matter of fact, people who like to dominate children end up being in agencies like this because they can be paid to do it. And they have power to do it right in the face of parents and right in the face of everybody else. So there's a self-selection bias in who becomes these kinds of people that come into your home like this forcibly. And there's regulatory capture in the sense that there is an incentive. Once they come to your house and they start looking around, there's an incentive for them to find something in your house. The temperature of the water coming out of your water heater, or whether or not there's a mat in front of your bathtub. I mean, anything they can get their hands on to say you have an unsafe environment or somehow your children are endangered. Because they get paid by the more of these homes that they can invade and the more children they can capture. So there's an incentive built into the system for them to behave like this. So anyway, so supposedly someone, after years of Will Grigg exposing these agencies for the evil that they are, someone anonymously reports Will Grigg and says that his children are in danger. So these goons show up at his door, but they failed to bring a search warrant on their first trip. Now, this is something they often do. They often don't bother to get a search warrant because that means they have to go before a judge and all these other things. If they go the Homeland Security route, they don't even need to do that. But usually, because there are the tendency, for lazy slugs to work for Child Protective Services also, they tend to not want to do the legal footwork that they're supposed to do before they invade your home. So they'll often show up with no paperwork. And they'll demand, and they'll even threaten you, that you have to let them in. But if you stand your ground and say, if you don't have a warrant, you're not coming in. Sorry, get a warrant and come back. And that's what Will Grigg did. And they have to turn away. They have to go and get police. And they will. And they will come back. And they will come back violently. And Will knew this. So when they came to Will Grigg's house, and they banged on his door and demanded to come in and search his house and question his children, Will was smart enough and experienced enough that he told them, no, go away, get a warrant, and he closed the door. Now, Will is a nice guy, so he was polite. And so immediately, as soon as they left, he was smart enough that he had made certain preparations in his life. As soon as they left, Will grabbed his family, shoved them in the van, and got out of the entire area, out of the county, and completely out of reach of these people as quickly as possible. Now, keep in mind, there was absolutely nothing that Will had done wrong. The accusation had come from some anonymous source that was never revealed, and it was never revealed exactly what the accusation was. So Will snatches up his family, gets out of the county, and then he gets back to his house as quick as possible because he knows they're going to be there. They're coming after him. And so he goes to his house, and sure enough, here they all show up, and they search his house, and they ransack his house. And they can't really come up with anything significant, and so they leave him alone. And eventually he had to get out of the whole area. But now this is what these people do. There's a case. Now, Will was smart enough that he avoided the real tragedy by having his children out of there. If he had not acted like he did, who knows what could have taken place. There's a case up in New Hampshire, though, of a guy named Thomas Ball. And he and his wife were having some marital problems, and in the midst of a really nasty, and I say nasty as far as it, most of the situation was not, there was no physical abuse or anything like that going on, up to one point where he actually slapped his daughter, and brought some blood on her lip. And now that was horrible, and he shouldn't have done that. You know, and I'm not trying to make excuses for him, but that's the entirety of all the violence that Thomas Ball was ever accused of, was one time he slapped one of his daughters and brought some blood to her lip. And that is the only accusation of violence that was ever put against Thomas Ball, and he was never convicted for that. That's something that his wife accused him of in the middle of their breakup, but he was never convicted of that. That was only an accusation, and it didn't hold up in court. All right, but because of this, Thomas Ball got on their radar, so to speak. He was a person that they couldn't let go of, and they chased him relentlessly, and they dogged him at every corner. And even though the court said he was innocent, and even though the court said he's perfectly fine, he's not violent, he didn't hurt anybody, even though the court said that, Child Protective Services continued to pursue him, continued to punish him, continued to harass him. Eventually, it got to the point of where he was facing jail time because he couldn't pay. He couldn't pay their fines and so forth, so he was going to be facing jail time. And looking at jail time, once he goes into jail, those fines continue to go, but he's not making any payments at all because he doesn't have a job. He's in jail. And so he was going to be in a situation where he would be forever in jail because he would never be able to pay his fines. And so this is what he did. He walked up to the courthouse in Keene, New Hampshire. He poured a can of gasoline all over himself, and he lit himself on fire. He did so not because he was crazy. He did so because he was desperate. He wrote what some might call a manifesto, but it's a rather long article that he wrote explaining himself and why he did it. It is not what one might call a long, rambling, psychotic, blah, blah, blah. No, it's pretty concise, and he knew what he was talking about. The entire society had failed Thomas Ball. He was in a situation where he was going to basically spend the rest of his life in jail. He would never be able to, he had been denied the opportunity to see his children for years. He would never be allowed to see his children again. He would never be allowed to be out free in society again, all because he owed money because Child Protective Services got him on their radar, and they harassed him and harassed him and harassed him. And this went on to the point of where he felt he had no other choice. And to try to get attention to this cause, he did this horrific thing. And you know what? The news media almost entirely ignored it. There were two people that jumped on the story right when it happened, Ian Freeman and myself. And we did, both of us, did as much as we could do, as quickly as we could do it, to draw attention to what Thomas Bell had gone through and what he did. The police ran out almost immediately and cleaned up the mess. So they didn't even allow the news media to get there to see anything that happened. If it weren't for Thomas Ball, mailing his article to a local news agency, no one would have ever known why he did it, because the police covered it all up so quickly. They even destroyed the surveillance tapes and Ian attempted to subpoena and get those tapes, but before he could, the police there in Keene, New Hampshire destroyed the surveillance tapes. So that the images of this horrific act couldn't be spread around, so that these monsters in Child Protective Services could be protected for what they did to Thomas Ball. Now, within 24 hours or so of Thomas doing this to himself, a bunch of other news agencies started to jump on the story. Dave Ridley did a lot of great work on this, and there were others as well, trying to bring in the mainstream media, trying to get their attention. But mostly, the mainstream media ignored the whole story. Mostly, it was just a little pocket of us talking about it. And why was he that frustrated that he would do such a horrific thing to himself? Well, he's not alone. I mean, he took a different path than others have taken. But there's scores of people who have absolutely done nothing wrong. In his case, he did something wrong, probably. In all likelihood, he actually did smack his daughter across the mouth. And that was terrible, and he shouldn't have done that. But, you know, and I'm not making excuses for him. I'm just saying that anybody who's raised children, multiple children, and gone through all the problems of having children, and especially if there's pressures in their life where there's marital problems going on. Unless you've been in a situation like that, it's really hard to judge someone else for their mistakes and for what they did wrong. And so, yeah, so Thomas Ball probably did smack his daughter in the mouth, and he probably, that, you know, something should have probably been done about that. But the fact that the government agency's response to that was to harass this man for a decade and drive him to the point of setting himself on fire. And like I said, he's not alone. Will Grigg has documented this over and over and over, and others have too. The Cato Institute has done a lot of great work on this topic. But again, this is almost a guaranteed result of having a government agency responsible for child protection. When you put a government agency in charge of child protection or child education or anything else, then you guarantee through regulatory capture and self-selection bias, you guarantee that eventually at some point in time, the agencies created to do good will be the most threatening to whoever that is that they're, you know, in industry. An agency created to make sure that sugar is pure is the one that's most likely going to produce the exact opposite results of what you're expecting or what you want to begin with. And I'm just using sugar as an example. Anything that you create in an agency like that to do in government, because it's an immoral act to begin with. Government is based on immorality, based on aggression, and based on theft. And you cannot do good by doing evil. You cannot accomplish good by continually doing evil. And so it's illogical to think that you can create an agency of any kind to do anything good and actually, in the long run, produce good. It's a folly. It's part of the myth of the state. It's part of the religion of the state. So the conclusion I have to draw in this is that under the current circumstances, under the current aggression-based system, the greatest threat to children and to children's rights is the existence of the state. So anything, even the non-existence of any government whatsoever, and any chaos that may produce, is better than the current system we have. Because under the current system, the government itself is the greatest single threat to children, and the existence of the government guarantees that children don't have rights. So again, now when I finish this topic off in the next podcast in the series, I'll go into what a free society could look like and how a free society could provide protection for children and protect children's rights and so forth like this. And I'll get around to eventually the legal aspects and how a legal system could work in a free society. But I think it's easy to see this conclusion that aggression, as in the system we have now, is entirely aggression. Aggression cannot protect your property, it cannot protect your rights, and it cannot produce law. Now, on the topic of law, and on the topic of course, for this portion of the discussion for this podcast, I'm only telling the problems with the current system, and I'll get into the solutions on the next podcast. But under the current situation that we have with law, there's no possible way that true law can ever be established by government, and there's no possible way that justice can ever be produced. And I've used this example before, but take this for an example. Let's say someone breaks into my house. Let's say Jerry breaks into my house. Jerry breaks into my house, and he comes in the middle of the night, and he and I struggle. And Jerry shoots me, let's say. And so I fall down, and he grabs my, he grabs a TV and runs out. So now I'm shot, I'm injured, my window's been broken, how he got in, and he stole my TV. All right, under the current system, so I grab a phone and I call the police. And the police come out, and they investigate, and they maybe get me to the hospital if necessary. And they stomp around in my house and disturb everything. And under the best case scenario, they arrest, try, and convict Jerry, and they throw him in jail for assault, for breaking and entering, and for theft. All right? But here's the problem now. I'm going to have to pay the taxes that pay to support Jerry all the time he's in jail. And all the time he's in jail, he gets to sit there on a free ride. He gets his meals free. He gets his room for free. He gets heat and cooling for free. He gets all these stuff, all the things that he needs in life, maybe medical attention, everything he needs, he gets for free. And who pays for it? Me. Me and you. And you weren't even in on the thing. You had a part in the deal. You're not associated with me or him in any way, and yet you're paying to keep Jerry alive and healthy in jail and entertained. You pay for the barbells that he sits and pumps day after day after day to build his muscles, so the next time he breaks into my house, it'll go differently. You see? This is the current system. This is what we're told is justice. Jerry gets out in 3 to 5 years with good behavior. And now he's stronger, he's meaner, and he's better at what he does. That's what we're told by the state is justice. So what would real justice look like? Well, I'll go into this again. I'll go into this in the next podcast. But whatever justice might look like, it doesn't look like what we're told is justice. There's no possible way the current system can produce justice. Justice could only happen if I am compensated for my losses and recompense is made. In other words, he's got to pay for shooting me in the leg. And when I say pay, well, how would he pay me back for shooting me in the leg or wherever he shot me? How would he pay me back for that? Well, it's all according. You know, it could be that I could never feel right about it until I get to shoot him. That may be justice. Or it might be that maybe if he works for me and does all my yard work for the next 10 years, maybe that would be justice. I don't know, because every situation is different. If I get shot in an attempted robbery in my home, I might have one way of looking at it, but if you get shot, you might have a whole different way of looking at it. There might be a good Amish person down the road that if a guy breaks into his barn and kills his cow, he might think, well, you know, as long as the man tells me that he's sorry, then I'll forgive him for it. And that may be justice to that guy. Or it may not. He might say, I can't have justice until my cow is paid for. Or he might say, that was my favorite cow. I've had that cow for 15 years. I didn't give birth. I held that cow as it was being born. That's my favorite cow. That cow comes to me when I call it by name. And who knows what it might take for that Amish man to feel like justice has been served. Only he can know that. A court can't figure that out. A judge can't figure that out, especially not one that's put in place through a series of self-selection bias. A judge put in his job through the use of self-selection bias, who's never had a cow, cannot in any possible way explain to this Amish man how justice can be served. Only the Amish man with a cow can know. If I get shot in a home burglary, only I know what justice is. If you get attacked on the street, only you know what justice is. And I'll talk about systems like that in the next podcast on this series. So, I was going to give the commercial for the contest, and I don't have time. So all I'm going to say is, if you want to win the DVD, Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1, Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz, go to Facebook, find badquaker.com, spelled badquaker, D-O-T-C-O-M, and post on the wall there, I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. If you don't have a Facebook account, email badquaker@badquaker.com, put DVD in the subject line, and put in the body of the email, I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. And send that to badquaker@badquaker.com. Do that, and we'll put you on the list. The contest absolutely ends Sunday, October 14th, 2012. U.S. addresses only. Must be 21 or older. No purchase necessary. No, not valid. We're prohibited by evil overlords. And we won't sell, trade, or do anything evil or stupid with your email address. And we won't hassle you in any way. We won't spam you or anything else. And for folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much.